Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock. First on this week's program, we kept our soul. GOP keeps blocking repeal of Arizona abortion ban. This story was written by TJ LeHeru and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on April 19th. All but one Republican in the Arizona House blocked a motion Wednesday to bring to a vote a repeal of the state's recently resurrected 1864 ban on abortion, which has no exceptions for rape or incest. Representative Matt Gress, a Republican running for re-election in a swing district that straddles Phoenix and Scottsdale, joined the members' 29 Democrats in trying to force a vote on House Bill 2677. The bill would repeal the abortion bill, which was reinstated by the Arizona Supreme Court on April 9th. Lawmakers have tried several times since the ruling to repeal the ban. Yet, on Wednesday, none of Gress's Republican colleagues, who said they favor repealing the ban, were willing to cross party leadership and vote to consider the bill. Representative David Cook of Globe confirmed that he, Representative Tim Dunn of Yuma, and Representative Justin Wilmoth of Phoenix would join Gress in voting to repeal the abortion ban, according to Arizona Agenda. But when a motion to bring the repeal to a vote in the House was made, only Gress sided with Democrats to vote in favor. If it sounds unnecessarily complicated, a few facts are worth considering. Cook, Dunn, and Wilmoth all voted in favor of a 2022 bill banning abortion after 15 weeks, which was signed into law by then-Governor Doug Ducey. But the bill did not supersede the state's 1864 ban, a fact the state Supreme Court cited in its ruling last week. The three representatives could have broken with their party to deliver the votes necessary to bring the repeal to a vote, but they balked. House Speaker Ben Thoma, who is running for a U.S. House seat in a comfortably Republican district, and first must best a competitive primary field of right-wing candidates, has every reason to try to grow his status among extremists. He voiced opposition to overturning the abortion ban immediately after the state Supreme Court's decision. Thoma likely is biding time to gauge the political and legislative implications of the court decision. Former President Donald Trump and Republican U.S. Senate candidate Kerry Lake publicly said the Arizona ban goes too far, though Lake has been noted for flip-flopping dramatically on abortion. Less than 2 years ago, she said she was thrilled about the great 1864 law. While the push to repeal the abortion ban failed in the House, the effort moved forward in the state Senate on Wednesday. Republican Senators T.J. Shope of Coolidge and Shauna Bullock of Phoenix joined the chamber's 14 Democrats to support a motion from Senator Anna Hernandez of Phoenix to introduce a repeal. Both Shope and Bullock were among the Republican lawmakers who voted for the 2022 law that did not repeal the 1864 ban. They both criticized the near-total ban after the state Supreme Court's ruling. It could take several weeks for legislation repealing the ban to reach the Senate floor for a final vote. Do the right thing. Top statewide Democrats, including Governor Katie Hobbs and Attorney General Chris Mays, blasted Republicans on Wednesday for their unwillingness to let the repeal receive a vote. Republican extremists in the House have yet again failed to do the right thing, Hobbs said in a written statement. In just 1 week living under this new reality, women, doctors, and healthcare providers have already begun to feel the devastating effects of living under a total abortion ban. We cannot go on like this. A law from 1864, written by 27 men, cannot be allowed to govern the lives of millions of Arizona women, Hobbs added. It's time to put politics aside and do the right thing. Mays, who announced that she would not prosecute women or doctors under the 1864 law, said Wednesday that her office would continue exploring legal strategies to fight back against the law. She also blasted Republicans for their hemming and hawing. It is abundantly clear that the majority party wants this 160-year-old law to take effect, Mays said in a statement. Complicated or complex decision-making is not required to repeal this insane law that doesn't even include exceptions for rape or incest. Shame on the Republicans for risking the health and lives of women in this state and for criminalizing doctors and nurses for caring for their patients. Mays said Tuesday that the earliest the ban could be enforced is June 8th. At a press conference Wednesday after the motion to vote on the repeal failed, Democratic State Representatives Stephanie Stahl Hamilton of Tucson and Oscar De Los Santos of Phoenix told reporters that they would keep pushing to nullify the abortion ban. Republicans failed to show up for the people of Arizona, said Stahl Hamilton, who sponsored the repeal bill. Keeping this archaic law on the books is their signal to us that they would rather cling to an ideology than show up and serve our people with wisdom and compassion. De Los Santos, who is the assistant minority leader for House Democrats, highlighted the difference between the parties with a sharp contrast. If you believe that a 12-year-old who has been raped by her stepfather should be forced to give birth, vote for the Republican Party, De Los Santos said. We are in an election cycle that is truly about freedom versus fascism, and we are seeing it play out in real time. The Republicans today turned their backs on the vast majority of Arizonans, Democrats, Republicans, and Independents, who want this law repealed immediately. When efforts to move forward a repeal failed on Wednesday, Representative Alex Kolodin of Scottsdale rejoiced in Republicans' efforts to block the motion to vote on the appeal. We held the line for what we as Republicans know is right, said Kolodin, who then received a rebuke from Republican Speaker Pro Tem Travis Grantham for addressing noisy supporters of the abortion ban in the gallery and eliciting applause. For now, we kept our soul, we kept our faith for one more week. Supporters of banning abortion came out in droves to the House on Wednesday, overflowing from the gallery to the building's hearing rooms. They frequently booed and shouted, "Amen, glory to God," or other religious interjections. "A lot of people in witchcraft are being saved," said one woman in a hearing room. "It's amazing." Next, a story written by Caitlin Sievers of the Arizona Mirror and posted on the New Times website on April 18th. Arizona Republicans respond to Hobbs' veto by attacking trans people. A slew of Republican bills, including those that allowed discrimination against transgender people and gave public school teachers a green light to post the Ten Commandments in their classrooms, were vetoed by Governor Katie Hobbs on Tuesday. Hobbs, who has made it clear that she'll use her veto power on any bills that don't have bipartisan support, and especially ones that discriminate against LGBTQ+ people, vetoed 13 bills, bringing her count for this year to 42. Republicans responded with obvious outrage to Hobbs' veto of their Arizona Women's Bill of Rights, which eliminated any mention of gender in state law, replacing it with a strict and inflexible definition of biological sex. The bill called for the separation of sports teams, locker rooms, bathrooms, and even domestic violence shelters and sexual assault crisis centers by biological sex, not gender identity, greenlighting discrimination against transgender Arizonans. As I have said time and time again, I will not sign legislation that attacks Arizonans, Hobbs wrote in a brief letter explaining why she vetoed Senate Bill 1628. Arizona Senate Republicans' response to the veto was filled with discriminatory language about trans people and accused them of merely pretending to be a gender different than when they were assigned at birth. With the radical left attempting to force upon society the notion that science doesn't matter and biological males can be considered females if they feel like they are, Katie Hobbs and Democrats at the Arizona State Legislature are showing their irresponsible disregard for the safety and well-being of women and girls in our state by killing the Arizona Women's Bill of Rights, Arizona Republicans wrote in a statement. The Senate Republicans went on to accuse the Democrats who voted against the bill of endangering women. Instead of helping these confused boys and men, Democrats are only fueling the dysfunction by pretending biological sex doesn't matter, Senate President Warren Peterson said in the statement. Our daughters, granddaughters, nieces, and neighbors are growing up in a dangerous time where they are living with an increased risk of being victimized in public bathrooms, showers, and locker rooms, because Democrats are now welcoming biological males into what used to be traditionally safe single-sex spaces. But transgender advocates say, and at least one study has found, that there's no evidence allowing transgender people to use the bathroom that aligns with their identity makes those spaces less safe for everyone else who uses them. In the statement, the bill sponsor, Senator Sinead Kerr, Republican Buckeye, claimed that the bill stopped transgender girls from competing in girls' sports, something she said gives them an unfair advantage. But Republicans already passed a law to do just that in 2022, when Republican Governor Doug Ducey was still in office, though that law is not currently being enforced amidst a court challenge filed by two transgender athletes. GOP accuses Hobbs of abandoning God with appeal. Republicans also clapped back at Hobbs' veto of Senate Bill 1151, which allowed teachers or administrators to teach or post the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms, a measure that some Republicans even questioned as possibly unconstitutional. In a statement, the bill sponsor, Senator Anthony Kern, Republican Glendale, accused Hobbs of abandoning God with her veto. As society increasingly strays away from God and the moral principles our nation was founded upon, Katie Hobbs is contributing to the cultural degradation within Arizona by vetoing legislation today that would have allowed public schools to include the Ten Commandments in classrooms, Kern said in the statement. In her veto letter, Hobbs said she questioned the constitutionality of the bill and also called it unnecessary. During discussion of the bill in March, several critics pointed out that posting the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms, tenets of Judeo-Christian religions, might make children whose families practice other religions feel uncomfortable. Sadly, Katie Hobbs' veto is a prime example of Democrats' efforts to push state-sponsored atheism while robbing Arizona's children of the opportunity to flourish with a healthy moral compass, Kern said. Another Republican proposal on Hobbs' veto list was Senate Bill 1097, which made school board candidates declare a party affiliation. School board races in Arizona are currently nonpartisan. This bill will further the politicization and polarization of Arizona school district governing boards, whose focus should remain on making the best decisions for students, Hobbs wrote in her veto letter. Partisan politics do not belong in Arizona's schools. Phoenix Suns superfan Mr. Orange arrested on child sex charges. This next story was written by Stephen Lemons and posted on April 17th. Peoria police arrested Patrick Petillo, a Phoenix Suns superfan known as Mr. Orange, on April 9th, on allegations that he solicited sexual photos and videos from Miners, who played on the Peoria High School boys basketball team he coached. The local celebrity, 37, who paints himself orange and is a fixture at Suns games, was initially charged with one count of luring a minor for sexual exploitation and one count of child sex trafficking. A grand jury later indicted Battillo on four counts of attempt to commit sexual exploitation of a minor. Four students at Peoria High School, all of whom are on the basketball team and range in age from 15 to 16, claimed that Battillo asked them for photos of themselves nude and performing sex acts, according to probable cause statements from the Peoria Police Department. One of the students claimed Battillo paid him for nude images of himself, according to the statements. On April 10th, Battillo appeared before court commissioner William Coffin, who set Battillo's bond at $100,000. Battillo's next court appearance is scheduled for Thursday. Court records include a summary of police interviews with two students whom Battillo contacted on Snapchat, allegedly asking for sexual images and videos of themselves. Battillo allegedly told one of the students, who was 16, that he sold an unknown woman sex videos of himself masturbating in showers. The boy told police this, quote, "weirded him out." Battillo allegedly asked the teen if he was interested in selling the woman similar images and videos of himself. Battillo promised the student that no one else would see the material. The student agreed to the proposition and then went onto a social media platform and obtained a couple of masturbation videos and sent them to Patrick via Snapchat, according to the summary. Battillo replied, telling the teen that the woman wanted to see the student's face. But the teen did not want to send Battillo an image of his face. Patrick then asked for the victim to spread his ass on camera or piss on self. The victim felt disgusted with that request, the police documents noted. Battillo also allegedly requested that the teen send videos of him having sex with his girlfriend, who also was a minor. The student told police that he did not believe the unknown woman existed and that Battillo was pretending to be the woman, according to the summary. He asked Battillo for the woman's Snapchat username. Once the teen had it, he asked the woman for an image of herself, but she did not send one, the summary added. The boy confronted Battillo about his suspicions, but Battillo denied that he was pretending to be the unknown woman, the summary said. In another Snapchat conversation, the student said Battillo had explicit instructions on what photos he should send the unknown woman. Solo with nut. Showers with nut. Smashing. Sex with a girl. Top. Oral with a girl. And the victim masturbating. Patrick added all with nut and full face as you nut. Nut is a term used for ejaculation, a court document said. Battillo was just as explicit in his photo requests during text threads with the student, according to the probable cause statement. "I want you fucking and exploding a big cum all over," Battillo allegedly told the student. Police. Coach Pat asked for nudes from players on his team. Court documents also included an interview with another 15-year-old student. The teen claimed Battillo reached out to him on Snapchat after the student posted a selfie. "You know what you're doing," Battillo allegedly wrote. The next day, Battillo clarified, "bulge." The teen said Battillo later asked for videos of the student having sex with his girlfriend. According to court records, Peoria police arrested Battillo April 9th while his Honda Accord. Battillo initially agreed to speak to police, but when a police officer asked him about his involvement with students, Battillo declined to answer. A press release issued by the Peoria Unified School District said Battio has been the boys' basketball coach at the school since 2019. It also stated that Battio had completed a fingerprint and background check. Until now, no reports of misconduct have been brought to our attention from parents, students, or community members, the school district said. In 2023, Battio coached the Peoria Panthers to the Arizona 4A High School Boys Basketball Championship, according to the Arizona Republic. As Mr. Orange, Battio is beloved by Suns fans. He appeared at games dressed from head to toe in flashy orange attire, with his skin painted orange and spiked fake orange hair on his head. Battio's LinkedIn profile states that he has been self-employed as Mr. Orange since 2008. In 2021, Phoenix New Times included him in a list of Suns superfans. In 2012, he told New Times about his taste in music, which included R. Kelly and Michael Jackson. In October, Battio dropped the body paint and debuted a new look for Suns games that included face masks. In a videotaped interview online for the Courier News in Somerville, New Jersey, Battio, in full orange regalia, explained that he does not work for the Suns organization and that he has always paid for his game tickets and his airline travel to attend away games. I love what I do. I love giving back to the community. I love seeing the smile on people's faces when I meet them out in public or at the games or just on the streets or coaching, Battio told My Central Jersey in 2022. Battio hired himself out for personalized video messages on Cameo. In his pitch video, attired as Mr. Orange, Battio said he was available for, quote, any shout-outs, birthdays, anything you need, especially my Suns fans. Battio charged $45 for the service and received at least 4 orders, according to the website. Teacher charged for failing to report student complaints. Peoria police also arrested Peoria High School teacher Holly Jean Holgate in connection with the case. Holgate, 46, faces charges of hindering prosecution and failing to report the abuse or neglect of a minor. Court records state that during the school day on April 9th, the 4 boys informed Holgate of Battio's behavior, playing a recorded conversation between Battio and one boy. Holgate allegedly sent 2 of the students to the front office and the other 2 back to class. She then walked to Battio's class and informed him of the boy's accusations, after which Battio left the school, according to court records. Holgate, a full-time employee, worked at the school since 2000. Battio was not an employee at the school, but did receive a stipend for coaching. Holgate and Battio were placed on leave pending the outcome of their criminal cases, the school district said. Holgate's next appearance in court is Thursday. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeroux and was posted on April 17th. FBI arrests Phoenix pedo cop on child porn charges. The FBI arrested a Phoenix police officer on April 5th for allegedly receiving and processing thousands of images and videos of child pornography. Gilbert resident Ala Robert Bartley, 41, was indicted 3 days later by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of Arizona. He was charged with 1 count of receiving child pornography and 1 count of knowingly possessing child pornography. Bartley faces a sentence of 5 years to 20 years in prison and a fine of up to $250,000 on the receiving charge. The possession of charges carry a maximum sentence of 10 years or 20 years if the pornography depicts a minor who is not yet 12, as well as a fine of up to $250,000. The Phoenix Police Department said it was deeply troubled by the arrest. We will remain transparent through this process and will provide updates when appropriate, the department said in a press release on April 5th. Yet the statement did not include the name of the officer arrested, and police have since refused to release a photo of Bartley. Bartley, a Phoenix officer since 2007, was placed on paid administrative leave after the arrest and faces a department disciplinary process. In an April 8th statement, the agency called the alleged crime despicable. What is alleged is contrary to the courageous work done every day by the men and women of the Phoenix Police Department to protect one of the most vulnerable populations in our community, our children, Chief Michael Sullivan said in the statement. Bartley exchanged messages, images, videos, calls, and internet links over the messaging platform WhatsApp with an adult woman named Sarah Chadwick, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. The two expressed their sexual interest in children, and Chadwick allegedly sent Bentley child pornography images. Bartley used a fake name, but said he was a police officer, and sent a picture of his face to the woman, according to the indictment. Chadwick, who lived in Pontiac, Michigan, was arrested in November 2023 and charged in December. It's pretty bad that I'm a pedo cop. The indictment includes an affidavit from FBI agent Jonathan Williams, who investigated the case. Williams wrote that he reviewed approximately 7,500 pages of conversations between Bartley and Chadwick that took place between August 2020 and February 2022. According to the affidavit, Bartley and Chadwick frequently role-played as daddy, or a police officer, and a female minor between the ages of 6 to 16 years old. In one conversation from September 14, 2020, Bartley allegedly told Chadwick, "It's pretty bad that I'm a pedo cop," the affidavit says. 4 days later, according to the affidavit, Bartley apparently described a time during which he interacted with his boss's 9-year-old daughter and later masturbated to thoughts of her. On June 20th, 2021, Bartley allegedly asked Chadwick to acquire nude photographs of a 14-year-old Tumblr user named Teen Angel. "I think it would be hot for you to groom minors for daddy," Bartley wrote, according to the affidavit. "Is that too much?" "IDK," Chadwick responded. "After I said it, I realized how weird of a situation that is," Bartley then said. In a conversation on July 7th, 2021, Bartley discussed how he might molest his nieces, the affidavit notes. A few months earlier, Bartley told Chadwick that he fantasized the most about his youngest niece, who was 6 years old. During the approximately 17 months of communications between the two adults, Chadwick allegedly sent child pornography to Bartley on several occasions. Bartley often acknowledged receiving photos and thanked Chadwick. On April 4th, 2024, the FBI searched Bartley's home and personal autos, as well as his Phoenix police cruiser and locker. Agents found a phone, bottom drawer of a nightstand at Bartley's residence. Bartley's wife stated this phone was the device her husband used to view pornography, though she said she did not know of him ever viewing child pornography. She did know the PIN to unlock the phone, however, and told Williams that Bartley had an affair in 2018, after which he agreed to allow her access to the phone for transparency. She told Williams she never accessed the device. An FBI forensic analysis of the phone discovered more than 49,000 images and 700 videos, many of which were identified as children sexual abuse material, or CSAM, the official name for child porn, according to the affidavit. Agents familiar with child pornography files on the internet identified a number of images that, based on their experience of viewing this material and enhanced by the context of chats, appeared to be CSAM, Williams wrote in his affidavit. Williams included several written examples, including the contents of the images and videos found. Two images depicted a young girl, quote, who looks no older than 7, engaged in sexual activity. Next, a story written by T.J. LaHiru and posted on April 16th. Phoenix fires cop involved in fatal shooting of Somali refugee. The Phoenix Police Department fired an officer on April 10th for his involvement in the April 2022 fatal shooting of 34-year-old Ali Osman. Officer Jesse Johnson, who allegedly shot at Osman at least 3 times, was terminated by Chief Michael Sullivan after an internal investigation by the department found that Johnson's conduct was not in line with its policy, according to a statement from the agency. The decision was not made lightly, but was done after careful consideration of all the facts, agency spokesperson Sergeant Robert Scherer said in the statement. The Phoenix Police Department must hold its employees to the highest standards, conduct, and accountability. Scherer also noted Johnson can appeal the termination to the Civil Service Board. ABC 15 reported that the Phoenix Law Enforcement Association said it was unfair to hold one half of the interaction 100% responsible for the outcome. The Officers Association did not respond to Phoenix New Times' requests for comment. Johnson's firing for conduct not in line with department policy was the first since May 21, 2020, Scherer told New Times. Jeff Cook, one of 2 officers involved in the killing of Ryan Whitaker, was terminated but reinstated by the Civil Service Board on December 9, 2021. Alistair Adele, then the Maricopa County attorney, didn't charge either of the officers for Whitaker's killing. Sergeant Brian Bauer, a police spokesperson, told New Times the department will not release any information about how Johnson violated its policy until it finishes its investigation into the other officers and the Civil Service Board reaches its own final decision about the officer's conduct. Johnson's firing comes as the city of Phoenix is trying to avoid independent oversight of its police department. The U.S. Department of Justice has been investigating Phoenix police for more than 32 months out of concern that the department has engaged systematically in excessive use of force, discriminatory policing, retaliation against protesters, and violation of the rights of unsheltered and disabled people. Depending on what the Justice Department finds, it may seek a consent decree, a legally binding performance improvement plan that city officials are determined to avoid. City officials also recently undercut the director of its own police oversight agency, the Office of Accountability and Transparency. The director, Roger Smith, submitted his resignation on January 29th. Events have led me to conclude that OAT does not have the independence required to effectively perform its responsibilities, Smith wrote in his resignation letter. Let's get this motherfucker, the killing of Ali Osman. Osman's death sparked an outpouring of grief and anger in Phoenix. The Somali refugee struggled with mental health issues, according to friends and family. He's someone who needed help, Mukhtar Sheikh, a community organizer who knew Osman, told New Times in September 2022. Johnson was one of 3 officers who encountered Osman on September 24, 2022, when Osman threw 2 rocks at a patrol car that drove past him on 19th Avenue. 1 rock caused minor damage to the car, in which officers Jared Gibson and Brennan Olakia were riding. The 2 officers stopped and convened with Johnson, who was in another vehicle. They returned to their respective cars. Let's get this motherfucker, Olakia told Gibson, according to body camera footage released by Phoenix police. Yeah, Gibson said. The three officers then returned to the intersection where Osman was standing on a patch of gravel off 19th Avenue. Olakia and Gibson had a less lethal shotgun in their patrol vehicle, and one officer had called for helicopter support. But when the three officers arrived where Osman was standing, the helicopter hadn't arrived, and the officers did not use the less lethal option. Instead, Johnson pulled up beside Osman and immediately left his patrol car with his gun drawn. Osman threw a small rock at Johnson, which hit the officer's shin. Within seconds, Johnson shot Osman three times. Olakia then exited the other car and also shot Osman. Osman was hit at least three times in the neck. He was one of 10 people Phoenix police shot and killed in 2022. In 2023, officers shot and killed 12 people. According to a lawsuit filed by Osman's family, it took 2 minutes for the officers to provide any aid to Osman, which limited body cam footage provided by Phoenix police after the incident did not clearly show. Both officers repeatedly scream, "Get down! Stay down! Show me your hands! Show me your hands now!" and "Let me see both of your hands," for 2 entire minutes in the direction of Mr. Osman's dead body, the lawsuit alleges, basing its account on body cam footage that the Osman family's legal team reviewed. Phoenix City Council voted on November 1st to pay a $5.5 million settlement to Osman's family. The family's attorney, Quasi Smith, said he was appreciative of the city of Phoenix for the speed with which a settlement was reached. "We believe that the decision by the city council today was an effort to try to make it right for our clients," Smith said. The settlement was approved in a 6-1 vote, with Councilmember Jim Waring casting the lone vote against it. Waring said that Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell's decision not to prosecute the officers was one of the reasons for his vote. Mitchell's office had not responded to New Times' request for comment by the time of publication. Mayor Kate Gallego told New Times in November that Osman's death was a problem of policy. "The problem was at a policy level," Gallego said. "We did not have the right policies guiding how to respond. So we have dramatically changed what we would do today." Phoenix, number 7 most forgetful city, Uber says. This next story was written by Dalen Adams and was posted on April 17th. Uber dropped its 2024 Lost and Found Index on Wednesday. The annual roundup lists items left behind in Uber rides around the U.S. and calls out what the company dubbed its most forgetful cities. Phoenix cracked the top 10 at number 7. The index also ranks the 50 most unique objects left behind, and there's no shortage of lost oddities. Is anyone in the valley missing a frontal toupee or 2 containers with spiders in them? Most forgetful U.S. cities. In order, the most forgetful U.S. cities are Miami, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, Orlando, Phoenix, Tampa Bay, Denver, and Austin. At least the valley isn't Miami. Who wants to be part of those infamous Florida Man headlines? The index also includes the company's most unique items left behind, including a hot sauce and a breathalyzer combo. Number 1, frontal hair toupee. Number 2, hot sauce and a breathalyzer. Number 3, I left a leaf in your car that's much needed. Number 4, 2 containers with spiders in them. Number 5, a Beyonce fold-up fan. Number 6, a tray of meat pie. Number 7, ceramic cat. Number 8, jar of oysters. Number 9, a personalized blanket with a picture of me and my dog. Number 10, small rat skeleton prop. Number 11, candle that says, "See you in court." Number 12, a fake tooth slash retainer. It's a really small plastic piece with a fake tooth in it. Number 13, gray tub of surgical implants. Number 14, police grade handcuffs. Number 15, my live pet animal turtle. Number 16, waste beads and a burrito steamer. 17, I left expensive blueberries that are special that I need that the store is completely out of. There's two packages that I absolutely need. 18, my girlfriend's pregnant pills. 19, small box containing a gnome. 20, stand-up paddleboard paddle. 21, painting from SeaWorld. It was wrapped in a roll, and I love it. 22, a playbill from the Spamalot show at the Kennedy Center. 23, my robot. 24, Benihana garlic butter. And 25, contraceptive Plan B from Costco and a Bobby Bliss Pro massager machine. The top 20 food items forgotten include several standouts ranging from a whole smoked pork belly and a cooler with meat to a small container of valuable honey and a jar of oysters. The most forgetful day of the year is January 21st, and 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. is deemed the losing hour. The most popular hours of the day lost items were reported, the report says. If any of these sound familiar, Uber's help page could pave the way for a long-awaited reunion with your prized Benihana garlic butter. Here's a story from the New Times Sports Desk, written by Matt Henney and posted on April 18th. Salt Lake sucks. Arizona Coyotes packing their pucks for Utah. How did we get here? Years of mismanagement, a bankruptcy, arenas that suck, billionaires with bad karma. Take your pick. Editor's note, this story was updated to add that the NHL approved the move on Thursday and include reaction from the league and team owners. From Winnipeg to Phoenix, a bitter divorce in Glendale, rejections in Tempe, and now the troubled yet somehow beloved Arizona Coyotes are ending their nearly 28-year relationship with the Valley and moving to Salt Lake City. The NHL Board of Governors approved the move on Thursday. The relocation is really a story of how fans love to hate the team's billionaire owner, Alex Morello, but love the NHL franchise, even without it ever advancing to the Stanley Cup Finals. On Wednesday, the Coyotes gave fans something to celebrate, defeating the Edmonton Oilers 5-2 in a game at Mullet Arena, which was packed to its 4,600-seat capacity. Players signed jerseys and any swag they could get their hands on to give to fans who stuck around long after the game to savor the moment. That was, of course, after fans vented their frustration, breaking out into chants of "Salt Lake sucks" at least 3 times during the game. Afterwards, the team posted a goodbye to social media. "To the most loyal and amazing fans, we love you." What happens next? The Fat Lady is singing for the Mullets. NHL owners approved the sale on Thursday. Ahead of the sale, the move was likely to see the league purchase the Coyotes for $1.2 billion, move the team to Salt Lake City, and flip the franchise to Ryan Smith, a billionaire who owns the NBA's Utah Jazz. Morello, proving again that billionaires fail upward, will pocket $1 billion from the sale and retained rights to start an NHL expansion team within 5 years. We are honored to bring an NHL team to Utah and understand the responsibility we have as stewards of a new NHL franchise, Ryan and Ashley Smith said in a statement on Thursday. This is a transformative day for our state and our fans. Morello is likely to continue with efforts to purchase a 100-acre piece of desert land near Loop 101 and Scottsdale Road in North Phoenix. An auction for the property opens in June, with bids starting at $68.5 million. Morello wants to create a massive entertainment district that includes an arena, something the team tried and failed to convince Tempe voters to okay in 2023. Scottsdale Mayor David Ortega threw cold water on the proposal in an open letter on April 8th. He then walked back his criticism, but the damage was done. Morello said Thursday that he's committed to building, quote, a first-class sports arena. I agree with Commissioner Gary Bettman and the National Hockey League that it is simply unfair to continue to have our players, coaches, hockey front office, and the NHL teams they compete against spend several more years playing in an arena that is not suited for NHL hockey, Morello said. But this is not the end for NHL hockey in Arizona. I have negotiated the right to reactivate the team within the next 5 years and have retained ownership of the beloved Coyotes name, brand, and logo. I remain committed to this community, to building a first-class sports arena and entertainment district without seeking financial support from the public, he added. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman said the league, which ran the Coyotes from 2009 to 2013, remains committed to Arizona. The NHL's belief in Arizona has never wavered, Bettman said. We thank Alex Morello for his commitment to the franchise and Arizona, and we fully support his ongoing efforts to secure a new home in the desert for the Coyotes. We also want to acknowledge the loyal hockey fans of Arizona who have supported their team with dedication for nearly three decades while growing the game. What happened on Wednesday? As word spread that the game was likely to be the last for the Coyotes in the Valley, ticket prices spiked. Fans got emotional, organizing a whiteout to show their love. And Morello was nowhere to be found. For now, the Coyotes are still Arizona's team for one more day, Josh Doan told Cronkite News. He's the son of Shane Doan, the 21-year NHL veteran who spent his career with the Coyotes. The rink inside the Ice Den, the team's longtime practice facility in Scottsdale, is named for him. Also on Wednesday, Smith pretty much sealed the deal in remarks to the Sports Business Journal during an event in Los Angeles. There's no secret on what's out there online. Normally, not everything on the internet is true, but in this case, it's pretty true, Smith said. Ouch. How did we get to relocation? It was, after all, just April 4th, when the Coyotes released a glitzy promotional video about a new arena seemingly cementing their future in the Arizona. There was no hint of what had to be furious behind-the-scenes maneuvering by Team Brass and the NHL, plotting the quick exit from Arizona. How did we get to this point? Years of mismanagement, a bankruptcy, lack of playoff success, ill-suited arenas in which to play, billionaires with bad karma. Take your pick. The Coyotes were born of a failed World Hockey Association in 1996 and struggled to find a home in the Valley. They played at Footprint Center, then moved to Desert Diamond Arena in Glendale, before landing in 2022 at Mullet Arena, which isn't equipped to help a professional team generate the level of revenue needed to keep it afloat. It didn't help that the Coyotes aren't the Diamondbacks or the Suns. Or maybe it's because the New Times ranked Andre Tereni, the Coyotes head coach, is only the second sexiest man in Arizona sports. Sorry, bro. The Trunk Space. 20 years of weirdo fun at the Phoenix DIY venue. This next story was written by Benjamin Leatherman and posted on April 18th. Weirdos have always been welcome at the Trunk Space over the past 20 years. The same goes for local artists, performers, musicians, creatives, colorful characters, and others who are just outside the norm. The DIY art space and music venue, which was launched in April 2004 by artists Steph Carrico and JRC along Grand Avenue just north of Roosevelt Row, has been a unique part of downtown Phoenix's cultural landscape. It served as a talent incubator that has fostered the sort of outsider art, experimental performances, unusual artistry, musical oddities, or newbie bands not found elsewhere. We enjoy things that are definitely strange and outsider, Carrico told Phoenix New Times in 2020. Countless burgeoning artists and acts have gotten their start at the Trunk Space, including such notable bands and performers as AJJ, Ryan Avery, and Treasure Mammal. Hundreds of touring bands have also performed at the space over the past 20 years, such as indie duo Matt and Kim, punk icon Greg Turner, folk singer-songwriter Kimya Dawson, and electronic noise rock act Quintron and Miss Pussycat. These days, the Trunk Space is located on the grounds of the historic Grace Lutheran Church and is a nonprofit venture run by volunteers and overseen by a 10-person board. It maintains its focus on art and music of an indie, unusual, or outsider bent. To commemorate the Trunk Space's 20th anniversary this month, New Times has assembled a photo retrospective showcasing some of the people, performances, and art events held at the venue over the past two decades. Here are the captions for those photos. The side entrance to the Trunk Space's original location on Grand Avenue. Experimental electronic noise act The Coitus performs at Trunk Space in 2005. Phoenix punk band Father's Day, the costumed quartet of the world's worst dads, fronted by performance artist Ryan Avery, outside of the Trunk Space in 2005. Noodle the Cat, a ginger feline who was the mascot and owner of the Trunk Space's original location on Grand Avenue. Flagstaff musician Phil Buckman, performing at the Trunk Space in 2005 as one-man techno-rock act I Hate You When You're Pregnant. A member of colorfully costumed Japanese-American punk rock band Prelander Z, performing at the Trunk Space in 2005. The participants of a Hallows Eve pumpkin carve at the Trunk Space in 2007. Indie rocker and one-man band Quintron performs for a packed house at the Trunk Space in October of 2008. AJJ, then known as Andrew Jackson Jihad, performs at the Trunk Space in 2009. An art display at the Trunk Space in the summer of 2009 entitled The Grid, Band Edition, focusing on connections between Phoenix musicians. Some of the numerous bands included in the 2009 art display, The Grid, Music Edition, many of which have since broken up. Taraf de Grief, a Jewish folk music piano duo, at the Trunk Space in 2009. Local creatives Ryan Avery, Pete Petrisco, Andrew Jemsek, and Barb Zadelic performing as Uncle Scoo's Clubhouse, a twisted vaudeville-style monthly show that was featured at the Trunk Space from 2006 to 2009. Phoenix indie rock trio Budget Centra perform at a fundraiser for the Trunk Space in December 2009. Degentrification in December 2009 during a set at Trunk Space Fest, a one-night fundraiser for the venue. One of the many performances at Trunk Space Fest in December 2009. The work of local artist Janet DeBerg Lang on display at the Trunk Space in 2010. The crowd at the Trunk Space's 6th birthday celebration in 2010. The late Space Alien Donald Center, a local artist who performed as Phoenix's oldest gay Canadian rapper at Trunk Space in 2011. An updated photo of the interior of the Trunk Space original location along Grand Avenue in downtown Phoenix. Local indie band Mancat performing with a hybrid of Hall and Oates during the Real Coachella, a parody of the Southern California-based Music and Arts Festival in 2012. Local rapper Glass Popcorn on stage at the Real Coachella in 2012. Jason Crone and Tristan Jemsek of Phoenix indie band Hug of War at the Real Coachella in 2012. The late Stephen Pruitt, frontman for local indie electropop act Peachcake, during a performance of the band at the Trunk Space in 2012. The members of the Cult of the Yellow Sign, a tongue-in-cheek local doomsday cult and comedic performance art group, inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, in 2012. Singer-songwriter and punk icon Greg Turner performs at the Trunk Space in 2013. Comedian and musician Kevin Peterson, one of the hosts of the talk show Grand Avenue Live that was staged at the Trunk Space. Local playwright, performance artist, and Phoenix New Times contributor Ashley Naftool during a birthday party for H.P. Lovecraft in 2015. The crowd inside the Trunk Space during an album release show for Playboy Man Baby in 2018. Natalie Olivares and Amy Smith of the Outlandish Musical Improv, a long-form improv comedy duo inspired by Outlander, performed at the annual Ghost Fest in 2022. And a scene from The Riot Jam, an ongoing monthly improv comedy event for local women, non-binary trans, and genderqueer individuals in March of 2023. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hovrock.